Can you hear that, Matt?
Wow, I can hear.
I just want to comment on something that Chet said about people who are experts commenting on things that they really have no business talking about. And I guess we all kind of spill over into that. Vice President Al Gore wrote a book on ecology, more or less, and about how the Earth is being destroyed, et cetera, and made the statement that the global warming trend, I believe it is, could never have occurred because of volcanic activity. And this year, our Meteorological Society in Washington said, based upon research and evidence, horrible words, research and evidence, we believe that this local warming trend is being caused by volcanic activity. Wow. How can one administration be so wrong so often? Apologetics, defending the Christian faith. Y'all think I spoke fast before. Wait till you see this morning. I want to put everything. Okay, what I want to do. I want to talk about the Notre Dame game, but I'll talk to y'all about that in a break. And I'll tell you about Brian's Ribs. Is that where we went yesterday? Yeah. Boy, that was great. They asked me not to come back. They said nobody can eat that many ribs. That's not what they said. They said no white man can eat that many ribs. Why should I become a Christian? Like Francis Schaeffer said, that was one of his favorite questions to be asked by different people. Why should I become a Christian, Dr. Schaeffer? And Schaeffer said there was only one reason to become a Christian. Because it's true. If we're trying to win people into the body of Christ, and if we're trying to send our young folks out to college campuses and high schools and elementary schools to be as witnesses to those out there, then everybody, saved, unsaved, has to understand that Christianity is true. That's the only reason to be a Bible-believing Christian. And that's what we're trying to do this weekend, give you answers to those questions, simply because that's exactly what 1 Peter 3:15 tells us to do. Be ready always to give an answer to every man that asks you, or to give a defense. That word that's used there for answer in the Old King James or defense, the New King James, and many of the other translations, is the word for apologetics. It's that Greek word, I believe it's apologia, that means a defense, a formal defense, like a legal defense. And that's what we're trying to do. Chet's done an outstanding job with the scriptural aspect. I'm trying to muddle through the science, and I realize it's a little hard. It gets boring because a lot of y'all don't enjoy science, and a lot of you may not hear many of these questions, but trust me, you've watched National Geographic enough. You've been exposed to all of this stuff, and it's exactly what the scriptures prophesized for the last day, 2 Peter 3:3-6. I'm not going to read it again. Peter goes through these things in the last day, and let me just say this. Down here where he says, whereby the world that then was being overflowed with water perished, he's referring to the flood, Noah's flood. Okay, he's not referring to a pre-Adamic flood, since it's coming after the creation. So tonight I want to kind of brush up a little bit on the gap theory. Somebody had some questions. Some people had questions about the gap theory, so I want to go back over that tonight. And tonight what I want to do this morning is try to fit all the science I can into answering these last two questions on Peter's prophecy. Remember we said that Peter, in that verse we just looked at, 2 Peter 3, verses 3 through 6, said in the last days there'll be scoffers walking after their own lust, questioning four things. The four things they question: second coming of Christ, age of the earth, creation versus evolution, and the whole concept of a worldwide flood. Now yesterday we did look at the age of the earth and the scientific data, okay? We looked at some of the problems with the old ages of the earth that's constantly thrown out at us. We said that, number one, when we can test those dating methods with rocks that we've already seen form, dating methods are inaccurate. In fact, we've never gotten an accurate date. We've never used rubidium, strontium, or uranium, lead, and gotten a 200-year-old date for a volcanic rock. That never happens. What we do get is millions and billions of years, which strongly implies that we're getting a mixture of these materials from the middle of the Earth. And that would be consistent with that explanation. The other problem is that we get negative isochrons. When we do little mathematical tricks to try to make our dates come out even, we get negative dates sometimes. What does that tell us? Probably a mixture. There's several theories that explain that, but I think that might be the right one. Second problem with the old age dating methods, we need information we can't get. How much did you lose over billions of years? I don't know. How much did you gain over billions of years? I don't know. Is the decay rate always constant? Well, we test it now, and it always is, but possibly you had enough energy during a worldwide flood, heat energy or electrical energy or changes in magnetic energy, to change those decay rates. We can change beta decay rates in the lab, but that doesn't account for the age. We can also change, theoretically, alpha decay rates if we can get enough energy. Problem is, can you generate that much heat or electrical energy or that much energy of whatever type during a worldwide flood? A gentleman submitted a paper basically saying yes, and Dr. Ed Boudreau back home with our creation group is working on another paper to look to see if that's a possibility. So you've got problems with old age dating methods, but from where I stand, and when I speak to folks and I say, well, hey, what about the age of the earth? What do you do with all those old age dating methods that's listed on TV and National Geographic and in my textbook? The question I always ask them, hey, what do you do with all the young age dating methods? And we looked at those. We said that there's a bunch, and that's not a complete list. There are a bunch of young age dating methods that give very young ages to the earth. And a lot of times, whenever you're talking to people and you're trying to present your viewpoint, positive evidence is very, very important. And now more and more with the old age dating methods, when people ask me, well, how do you deal with the old age dating methods? Rather than show them all the problems with their old age dating methods, you know what I do? I come right out and ask them, what do you do with the young age dating methods that are much better and require much fewer assumptions? And they look at me and they say, a la the book of Acts, we had not even heard that there'd be young age dating methods. And they're out there. Become familiar with those. Those are good. So going back to 2 Peter 3, we've looked at some of these dating methods. We've looked at where the attack is going to come in the latter days. And 2 Peter 3, 3 through 6 tells us that it's going to come from that area of creation science. Age, creation versus evolution, and the worldwide flood. And that's what I want to try to get through today. So that tonight, what I'd like to do is take this information and show you how I use it and answer some very, very important questions, or what I consider to be the most important question. How do you know the Bible is the Word of God? Well, the Bible says it's the Word of God. So does the Book of Mormon. So does the Quran. How can you show that the Bible is the Word of God, especially to somebody whose God is science? If their God testifies that the Bible is the Word of God, then if they're going to be intellectually honest and non-hypocritical, they're going to have to at least admit it. How can you do that? That's the question. The answer is absolutely yes, and that's what I love to do with both them. So what I want to do tonight is kind of pull that all together and give you questions to ask them. It's very, very important that we be ready always to give an answer to those questions, but we need to answer those questions also. This whole area of biblical veracity for our generation, the last days, as Peter calls it, deals with this area of creation science. Three out of four of the places in that 2 Peter 3 prophecy talk about creation science. We need to clear up this problem with the first verse in the Bible, "In the beginning God created." So often, whenever we're trying to share the gospel with folks, whenever I'm trying to share the gospel, this is what they attack. And they'll always say, if the Bible lies in the very first verse, how can you trust any of the rest of it? That's what folks in colleges and universities want to attack constantly, that first verse of the Bible. And it always comes back to evolution. And as you can see, evolution, as Chet was saying this morning, just wasn't confined to the scientific community. It has spilled over into everything. Everything evolved. The Bible evolved. The way we got the Bible evolved. Language has evolved. And that has become the predominant theory, that things change. Don't be deceived. Evolution, the definition of evolution, is not just change. It's upward change, improvement, more information, better organized, more useful, bigger, better, more improved. That's what evolution implies. And it's real, real important not to let somebody tell you that evolution means just change, because it doesn't mean just change. It means directional change, and it's always in an upward direction. For right now, 20th century America, where we live, the battleground from an evidential standpoint is creation science, more than anything else, as far as answering that question. Our strongest positive evidence, on the other hand, I don't think it's creation science. I think it's history. And that's what I'm going to talk to you about tonight. What is it that you could use that I think is beyond any dispute, beyond any argument, to confront folks and to establish their faith? Okay, let's talk about science this morning. And what I want to do is just say this. So many times people say that it's not evolution, it's not creation, it's one or the other. And I keep telling them, like this guy says, come on, it's one or the other. It is one or the other. That's all there is. It's either creation or evolution. It's got to be one or the other. Let's look at the evidence and see what it shows. And if you want to be a scientist and if you want to look at evidence from the natural world, and that's fine, because Romans 1:20 says that that's what the unbeliever ought to be looking at, right? But Romans 1:20 also, boy, the Bible's a put up a shut up book. Romans 1:20 tells me that there's enough evidence out there, those guys are without excuse. I should be able to show them that evidence and say, hey, here it is, right here. Okay. What about that evidence? Creation versus evolution. We're going to look at the evidence that's usually presented to favor evolution. It falls into these general categories. Big Bang explosion. That everything got here from a Big Bang explosion. That chemicals from that Big Bang explosion organized themselves, provided themselves with enough information, and became living critters. And then that little bitty, simple living critters became very complex living critters, even to the point of ape or an ape-like creature becoming you and me. That's the four areas that the evolutionist is going to look at, and he's going to say, that's what I've built my belief upon. Let's start with the area of the Big Bang. The Big Bang has several problems. A lot of people say, Mike, I don't understand all that astrophysics. Most of the astrophysicists don't understand all that astrophysics. They memorize the equations. I did that in calculus, too. But the problems with the Big Bang, number one, it violates the law of cause and effect. What caused the Big Bang to start? What caused the Big Bang to get there? There's no initial cause, and that leads right into number two. And you know what? A six-year-old child can understand it. I was talking to a fifth-grade class, and one of the kids said, Doc, where'd the Big Bang come from? And I said, well, the scientists say that the Big Bang came from this little bitty, tiny, small point of matter called the singularity. And so where'd that come from? I said, that's a good question. Scientists tell us that the singularity came from this eternal energy field. And so where did that come from? As Schaefer would say, he understood. He understood that you had to have a cause for this. What caused that? Well, what caused that? Well, what caused that? And it keeps going back in a line. And you have to eventually come to that first cause, which is an uncaused event for which there was no cause. Now, the evolutionist tells us now, those who cling to the standard Big Bang, the hot Big Bang theory, they want to tell us that that first cause was an eternal energy, listen to this, an eternal energy field which did not obey the laws of chemistry and physics. So if it doesn't obey those laws of the natural, it becomes supernatural energy. Well, what's the difference between a supernatural energy field and a supernatural personal creator God who communicates? You know what the difference is? The personal God communicates. He tells me that he was there. The energy field doesn't say anything, which means that you can't know that he was there, can you? This is evidential faith. An infinite personal creator God who says that he communicates to me and leaves me a written record. Just doesn't tell it to somebody, says write it down so that they don't forget it, and so that people can say, well, yeah, there it is. That infinite, eternal energy field doesn't communicate. Anybody who believes in that has what kind of faith? Blind faith. Show of hands, how many times have you been told as a Christian that you have blind faith? No one? Few of us? Yeah. Sure. Guess what? We don't have blind faith. They've got blind faith from where everything came from. But there is a requirement for a first cause, and it is legitimate to look at people and say, well, where did that come from? And when they get all the way back to wherever they're going to stop, be it the singularity, I call them silly strings, super strings, or an eternal energy field, please point out to them that they have blind faith, that no one's ever seen it, and that those energy fields have never communicated to them. Please point out that if they believe in an eternal energy field that violates the laws of chemistry and physics, then that's a supernatural non-being that they have a blind faith in. Please show them how religious they are. As Paul said, you guys are much too superstitious. That's exactly where they come from. Eternal energy versus eternal God. And then there's certain scientific problems with the Big Bang. Again, we don't know where it all came from. The scientists are trying to give us a naturalistic explanation of where everything came from, and they can't use it. They can't provide it using just the natural laws of chemistry and physics. They have to go back to a supernatural energy field. What made the Big Bang explode? Somehow this energy field, through a quantum fluctuation, which a lot of folks say could never occur, condensed itself into a singularity and then exploded. Well, if it was content to be a very, very small piece of matter, what caused it to explode? Another quantum fluctuation. Missing time. You need more time to form the giant structures that we observe out in the galaxies, according to the evolutionists, than there is entire time since the Big Bang. We see galaxies that are 15 billion light years away. It took several hundred million to several billion years for those galaxies to form, and yet they tell us that the universe is only 13 billion years old. By the best calculations, maybe 15 billion. Well, you're right on the edge. You don't have enough time to form those things. That's like saying my mom and dad are 40 years old, but I'm 42. Wait a minute, that doesn't wash. But you know, in order to believe that, you have to have a PhD. And it's sort of like Alice in Wonderland, where the queen said she got up in the morning and thought of so many impossible things before breakfast. These guys make a living at it. Angular momentum. Things rotate out there. In our solar system, we see things rotate. It looks like everything in the universe is moving around. You need angular momentum to give it that movement. The problem is when you start with an explosion based upon the laws of chemistry and physics, based upon the laws of physics, you start with an explosion where everything is moving out from the center, you don't have any force to provide angular momentum. Unless you can draw it all back together, but that's impossible because the attractive force is decreased with the square of the radius, so the further apart it gets, the less attraction you have. And in order to account for that, they've had to come up with missing mass. You see, you can't pull all this stuff moving apart back together unless you've got enough gravity to pull it apart. So what the scientists, the evolutionists have said is, well, the problem is that we're looking out there and we don't see the matter and the mass that would provide enough gravitation to pull it all back together. They call it missing mass. What they mean is invisible mass. They have no evidence for it whatsoever, but it's got to be there because it fits with their belief. Blind faith. Just say that it's missing. Don't say that it's missing. Say that it never existed. But that's what they appeal to. Do y'all see? And I don't want y'all to walk out of here and say, boy, I finally got all this stuff down. I realize that. But do you see the illogical arguments that are being put forth? That every time they find an observation that doesn't agree with their theory, do they throw the theory out and go with the observation? No, what have they done now? They've said it's beyond what we can observe. Well, that's like saying elephants only fly when they're invisible. And people say, wait a minute, Mike, no one's ever seen an elephant fly. And I say that proves my theory. They only fly when they're invisible. That's not science. That's bad science. And it's nonsense. No one's ever seen the explosion. This is wrong. This is atomic number 5 and 8. You can start building atoms by adding subatomic particles, but you can't get anything past atomic number 5 and atomic number 8, which means you can never get carbon, which means that we really don't exist. Maybe the Hindus and Buddhists are right. Maybe we are a figment of our imagination. Because of the Big Bang, scientists are starting to recognize it. Let me just read you some quotes from Jeffrey Burbidge, Scientific American, February 1992. He says, quote, Big Bang cosmology is probably as widely believed as been any theory of the universe in history of Western civilization. And what I want you to do is listen to this scientist, who is an evolutionist, who is not a creationist or a Christian, listen to what he has to say about the Big Bang so that no one will ever tell you, wait a minute, every scientist believes it. And I want you to see what he criticizes about the thought pattern of his fellow scientists. But I also want you to see how these guys make it stick. And it's just what Chet said this morning. They win through censorship. If you've got a theory, a belief, loaded with evidence that does not agree with the party line, you just don't get published, or you're denied telescope time. Let me just read what Burbidge has to say. Talking about the Big Bang, it rests, however, on many untested and, in some cases, untestable assumptions. Untestable assumptions is outside the realm of science. Indeed, Big Bang cosmology has become a bandwagon of thought that reflects faith as much as objective truth. Skipping down, those of us who would have been around long enough know that peer review and the refereeing of papers has become a form of censorship. Now, I'm not saying that. That's an evolutionist who's saying that. It is extraordinarily difficult to get financial support or viewing time on a telescope unless one writes a proposal that follows the party line. A few years back, Halton C. Arp was denied telescope time at Mount Wilson and Mount Palomar observatories because his observing program had found and continued to find evidence contrary to standard cosmology. He goes on to say there are good reasons to think the Big Bang model is seriously flawed, and then he lists a whole bunch of those reasons. It says, within the framework of the hot Big Bang, there is no satisfactory theory of how galaxies and larger structures formed. None of these ideas can be directly tested. He goes on and he talks about his model, the inflationary model, when he says the inflationary model is an untestable addition to the lore of the Big Bang. This model is at least one viable alternative that can explain all that we can see. There may be others, and he admits that there's always more than one interpretation out there. But he admits that his theory is lore, not science. Finally, he sums up by saying, the Big Bang ultimately reflects some cosmologists' search for creation and for a beginning. That search properly lies in the realm of metaphysics, not science. Isn't it wonderful that we don't have metaphysics as Christians? We have an historical eyewitness who says he was right there at the very beginning, he saw everything, he did everything, and he gives us truthful testimony, so much so that he says he cannot lie. Do you realize that biblical Christianity steps outside the realm of metaphysics and becomes an historical narrative. The only question comes down to this: how accurate and how reliable is my eyewitness? Would his testimony hold true in court? When he makes statements, can we verify it? And those that we can. And I say overwhelmingly yes. There's no question about it. Big Bang cosmology? Big Bang cosmology is falling apart, and it falls apart to some simple logic. It's now falling apart based upon the evidence. The next thing that the evolutionist likes to point to is this concept of turning chemicals into life. And that's essential for one simple reason. We call that abiogenesis. If you cannot take non-living chemicals and turn them into life, you have no evolution. It's right at the very foundation. It's like this guy right here. You keep opening up that little coffin, and you get down to that last little coffin. You say, okay, big life came from little life, and little life came from small life, and small life came from itsy-bitsy life, and itsy-bitsy life came from the first cell. That first cell came from where? If you say God, then you no longer have evolution. That first cell has to come from chemicals. And that's the main chink in the armor of evolution for one simple reason. You can go in the laboratory and test that. You see, the laws of chemistry and physics don't care if evolution is true or creation is true. It's just the laws of chemistry and physics. And we can go in the laboratory and repeat those experiments over and over and over again, and that's science. And we can then say, while science cannot prove an historical event, it can comment on it, and we can say at least whether or not it's scientifically feasible, possible, probable, that based upon the laws of chemistry and physics, we could get non-living chemicals to come together on their own using just the laws of chemistry and physics and form life. That we can go to a laboratory and test, and that's been done. And the person that's written the best book on that are three gentlemen, Thaxton, Bradley, and Olson. One of the men that started writing this book, and I believe it was Olson, was not a Christian when he started the book, was committed to evolution. And because of the scientific evidence, got saved. Said there's no way you can do it. You can't make chemicals into life. And this book is a little technical. I recommend it for those of you with a technical background who've had a little PCHEM and have a little bit of mathematics that you can understand the equations and information theory, because this book, in my opinion, puts the final nail in the coffin of evolution. Evolution all falls apart in getting that first living thing. And what Thaxton, Bradley, and Olson do is they go down the list. They say, if you want to make life from non-life, it's very, very simple. You've just got to get the right materials under the right conditions to get the right products of the right kind and the right amounts to have the right reactions at the right location, the right sequence with the right information to build the right structures and the right functions that make life. That's easy. But they said, we can go to the laboratory and test that. Now, there's a little bitty problem. It's a chain reaction. If one of these steps is violated, then the whole thing falls apart and you could never, ever get life from non-life. Never, ever. And what Thaxton, Bradley, and Olson do is they go down this list and they show you that absolutely in every single instance, based upon the laws of chemistry and physics, you could never, ever get any of that to occur. Overwhelmingly. It's not that evolution fails because of one bad point in the chain. It fails at every step of the way. And not because I say so. The experimental data is published in standard scientific journals. Go and look for yourself. And that's what Thaxton, Bradley, and Olson do. And every chain is necessary. Sort of like Noah on the boat when he says, well, so much for the unicorns, but from now on, all carnivores will be confined to sea deck. Every link in the chain has to be there. You can't miss anything along the way, or else it all stops. And that's what's being taught in the textbooks in school. Oh, goodness. So many times, people come to me and say, well, Dr. Roy, you know, I was looking at my textbook, or my son's textbook, that's from high school, and they make statements like, the idea that an organic soup could originate from a primitive atmosphere was first tested in the laboratory by Stanley Miller in 1953. And then it goes on to say, this demonstrates that complex organic molecules would have been produced from inorganic ones. What about those experiments, Dr. Gerard? Do they prove that life originated? And the answer is no. You can get complex organic molecules, but you can't make them form life. And the reason is you've got to get those complex organic molecules, the right ones, to come together. There's one big problem with the whole scenario of trying to get non-life, non-living chemicals to come together and form living chemicals, and that deals with the area of information. You see, when you look at you, you're made up of a genetic code. How can I say this? Everybody in this room started out as one cell. Just one little cell. And from that one cell, it turned into about 7 trillion cells that you now have. It turned into all the different cells that you have. It put all those cells in the right area. I say this all the time. All my years of medicine, nobody came into my office with a liver in their right ear. It puts everything where it's supposed to be. How do we do it? How can you start with one cell and it makes all the different cells and it puts them in the right place and it makes them work so well? How does it know that? You got a computer program in that first cell. And we call it DNA. It's the genetic code. And all it is really a program. And from that program, you make all the different cells. And every living creature has that genetic code in their cell that makes all the different cells, that makes all the different cells do what they're supposed to do. You know what's in that code? You know what it's made up of? Not letters of the alphabet like we do when we write things. We use letters. God uses chemicals. And it's incredible. He only uses five different chemicals to make the code work. He uses a total of 8 chemicals total in DNA. You and I need 26 letters of the alphabet? Something like that? Good. I've been out of second grade a long time. You forget all the good stuff. But God can do it with only 8 chemicals, 5 of them that make up the code. And by arranging those things in a certain order, like we do with letters, we can make that whole code. Now, what you need to put that thing in a code, any code requires what? Information. There's a whole science that deals with information. It's the science of information theory. The science of information theory, experimentally, you can show this, carries true to the second law of thermodynamics. The second law of thermodynamics basically says this. Things don't get better, they get worse. If you leave your automobile outside for 4 years, it will not evolve into a Mercedes-Benz. It will degenerate into junk. If you let your teenager go for a day or two at the most, his room will turn into chaos. My desk never stays nice, neat, and ordered. It gets worse. Things wear down, run out, lose information. And what they were able to show, especially during World War II, is that you can take the second law of thermodynamics, mathematically and experimentally apply it to the science of information theory. And one of the most important things that that second law of thermodynamics says about information is that if you start with a system, and I'm just going to use an example, that has 5 pounds of information, it could never, ever come from a system that only had 3 pounds of information. In order to get this much information, it had to come from a source that had at least that much or more. What does that tell us about us and our genetics and our DNA? It means that you could never come from a source that had less information. The first living cell, and let's say it would be something like an E. coli bacteria that has 10 million pieces of information in its DNA, could never come from chemicals that have essentially no information. And since you have about 2 billion nucleotides in your DNA, it couldn't come from the E. coli that only has 10 million. You couldn't go from amoeba to man, but you could go from man to amoeba. Do you see that? You can't get what you ain't got. And that's what evolution is demanding. You cannot go from chemicals that have practically no information to human beings that have enough information in their DNA to fill 2,000 volumes of books, 500 pages each, with the smallest readable print. And the evolutionists would have you believe that if you walked into a library with 2,000 volumes of books, 500 pages each, that it got there by an explosion in a print shop. How much sense does that make? That just doesn't work. And the science of information theory is what makes the computer industry work. It fuels our computer industry. It's what broke the German Enigma code in World War II. The fact that we could measure that drop, or rather that increase in information at certain random sequences. What they were measuring was entropy. I said, gee, the entropy drops here, there must be a message. So this works. It makes our industry work. You need to get the right sequence in the right order. Now, a lot of people say, well, wait a minute, Dr. Roy, you forget the second law of thermodynamics says that if I have an open system, that I can put energy into the system and I can get information. Because the sun hits the earth, we've got enough energy to turn those molecules into information molecules. Sure, you can do it. You can mathematically show how much energy is required. Can energy replace information? I want you to look at this. These are actual numbers. The amount of energy that's required to freeze water is only 1.4 kcal per mole. But if you want to take and make just a 4 million nucleotide bacterium, you would need 30,200,000 kilocalories per mole. That's enough energy to vaporize every one of those chemical bonds. So when people say, well, can information be supplied with energy? It's like asking the question, can you pour molten aluminum in a styrofoam cup? Temporarily, yeah. The energy that's necessary to replace information is overwhelming and will never work. You just cannot replace information with energy experimentally. And Faxon, Bradley, and Olson in their book summarized like this. When they were asked that question and they went ahead and answered it, they said this would be thermodynamically equivalent to having your bathtub spontaneously heat up to 360 degrees centigrade, happily a most unlikely event. Dr. Nalkar, is that because I say that? That's the laws of chemistry and physics. When we look at this whole concept of chemicals to light, I think that is the weakest chink in the armor. And it all comes down to one thing, this whole concept of whether or not you can get information into non-information systems without putting information into those systems. Do you understand what I'm saying? Can you get those chemicals to organize themselves without an outside information source? And the answer is no. If that would occur, there would be no reason to buy those expensive programs for your computer. All you'd have to do is just turn the computer on and let it program itself. You can calculate the probability of getting those things to come together, and the evolutionists have done that for us, and this is really convenient. The chance that one E. coli bacteria would form any place in the universe in 5 billion years was calculated by H.J. Morowitz to be 1 chance in 10 to the 100 billionth power. That's a 1 with 100 billion zeros behind it. The national deficit is a 4 or a 5, depending on what time it is, with 12 zeros behind it. $4 or $5 trillion. This is something with 100 billion zeros behind it. Those are bad odds, y'all. I'm serious. Play the lottery. Sir Fred Hoyle sums it up this way. The chance that higher life forms have emerged in this way is comparable with the chance that a tornado sweeping through a junkyard might assemble a Boeing 747 from the materials therein. And Hoyle's an optimist. He says the odds are only 1 chance in 10 to the 40,000th power. So he's being real, real optimistic. And he was the gentleman that when he looked at all of this, he developed a steady-state theory of the Big Bang, then mathematically disproved it, and finally came to the conclusion that there must be a God. He's not a Christian. He doesn't believe that God could talk, which is kind of ridiculous, but he does admit that there has to be some type of infinite first cause that would bring everything about. Did evolution occur in the past? So many times, I'll sit down there and I'll ask people, I asked this to a young girl at Houston's one day that was waiting on me in New Orleans, just graduated from Tulane University, and she had a master's degree in biology, and I said, oh, I said, you believe in evolution, huh? She said, sure, Dr. Ron. I said, well, what's your best evidence for evolution? She said, the fossil record. I said, oh, really? I said, can you quote me anybody who says that there's evidence in the fossil record? She said, well, not offhand. Tulane University is an outstanding university. They didn't do real well against Alabama yesterday, but academically, they got a real good school. But let me show you what Stephen Jay Gould, who is a vehement anti-creationist but is an excellent paleontologist, has to say about the fossil record and its proof of evolution. He says the absence of fossil evidence, the absence of fossil evidence, the intermediary stages between major transitions in organic design, indeed our inability even in our imagination to construct functional intermediates in many cases, has been a nagging and persistent problem for gradualistic accounts of evolution. You see, in the fossil record, the evolutionist Darwin at least said that you ought to have in-between forms, intermediate stages, transitional forms, one kind of animal turning into another kind of animal. That snake is going to evolve into that bird, so somewhere in that fossil record, we ought to find half snake, half bird, snurs, all over the place. And an individual set, and that's what they say. Well, you know what? That's really easy to do. In Darwin's day, Darwin had an excuse. He said, okay, we don't find transitional forms, but it's because the fossil record is so incomplete, we haven't dug enough. We're 100 years past Darwin. We've dug a bunch. Dr. Robert Broom says that the Great Karoo Formation in Africa, he's got 800 billion fossil vertebrates. Stephen Jay Gould, who is an expert in the fossil record, one of this country's foremost paleontologists, says, yeah, if you're looking for evidence there, it's not there. That's those in-between forms. In fact, he says the evidence is so bad, he came up with a different theory. Colin Patterson, senior paleontologist at the British Natural History Museum, I don't think anybody would argue with that, with the fact that he's the world's foremost paleontologist. He says this. Oh, well, let me tell you the background on this. He wrote a book on evolution. He included no examples of transitional forms. Lou Sunderland, an engineer from this country, from America, wrote Patterson. He said, Dr. Patterson, great book on evolution, but no examples, no hard evidence. Where are they? Patterson wrote back to Lou Sunderland. He said, quote, I fully agree with your comments on the lack of direct illustration of evolutionary transitions in my book, if I knew of any. Fossil or living, I would certainly have included them. I will lay it on the line. There is not one such fossil for which one could make a watertight argument. Where's the beef? David B. Kitt says it better than anybody else, though. Kitt said, quote, despite the bright promise that paleontology provides a means of seeing evolution, it has presented some nasty difficulties for evolutionists, the most notorious of which is the presence of gaps in the fossil record. In other words, no transitional forms. He goes on to say, evolution requires intermediate forms between species, and paleontology, the fossil record, does not provide them. Why is it still in the textbook? Why is it still on National Geographic and Discovery Channel when we know that television doesn't lie, especially since Rush Limbaugh's on? Simple or complex life? The evidence isn't there. Not in the fossil record anyway. Gentleman asked me a question yesterday about this concept of homology. This is serial homology. If you look at different creatures, bats, birds, porpoises, man, all have one big bone in the upper arm, two little bones in the lower arm, and five digits. And that type of homology, similarity, is repeated over and over and over again in all types of different creatures. And now the big thing is to say that human DNA and ape's DNA is 95% similar. Well, number one, we know less than 10% of the sequence of human DNA. How in the world do we know so much about ape DNA? We're not comparing sequence for sequence. What they're doing is a fancy wet chemistry experiment with all of its limitations, crystallizing the stuff out, measuring melting points to see how close they are. And that's what they're doing. So it's not that they're similar, it's that they melt at about the same temperature. Well, you put a monkey and a human in an oven and it would melt about the same temperature. What's the answer in homology? People say, well, gee, Mike, that looks, it really does sound really good. Just remember this. In order for things to be homologous, hang on, let me say it like this first. That idea of homology could mean relationship. Things could look alike because they're related. Brothers look much, much more similar than total strangers. But the truth of the matter is that similarity does not require relationship. The evolution has made a false assumption on that. Might have been a good assumption, but does it hold? Similarity does not require relationship, and I always do this. Parrots can learn to speak English just like humans. Parrots walk upright on two legs just like humans. Parrots fly like humans do, like my wife and I did down here. And parrots are covered with feathers like American Indians. So do you think you evolved from a parrot? Gee, look at all the similarity. Especially in the area of language. Apes don't speak. Don't have anything to say. Similarity does not require relationship. Similarity can be just like what you see in San Francisco. Golden Gate Bridge, which looks virtually identical to the Bay Bridge. Which bridge evolved from the other? Did you know that similarity most often means that you have an intelligent creator using a similar plan, purpose, and design under the same laws of chemistry and physics in the same universe to accomplish what he wants to accomplish? These two bridges are the result of an intelligent creator. Big bone, two little bones, five digits. That's the result of an intelligent creator. How do you know that, Mike? Well, in order for evolution to be true, these bones and all these different creatures would have to be passed on through relationship, right? In order for them to have a relationship, or in order for them to be the product of a relationship from one ancestor to the other, they would have to be passed on through what? DNA, genetics. Therefore, if these similar parts, these homologous parts in different creatures are really from evolution, heredity, passing it on from one similar creature to another creature, then we should be able to find these similar parts on the same or similar genes in different creatures. Right? If they're due to genetics, similar parts should be on similar genes. Hardly ever does that occur, and a lot of folks would say never. Never do you find similar parts and similar genes in different creatures. From the evolution standpoint, homology is an absolute failure. We don't see evolution occurring, do we? No. No place out there in the universe. Our breeding experiments, we've been doing breeding experiments for over 300 years with some of the best scientists in the world, farmers. Farmers are great scientists for one simple reason. When their experiments fail, they starve. And therefore, they make the most careful observations, and they tend to be blunt and honest when they report them. And after 300 years of breeding experiments with every different type of living creature available, we see kind reproduce kind. Cattle farmers will tell you they can get big cows, little cows, fat cows, skinny cows, ugly cows, cows with no horns, cows with big horns. But you start with a cow, you end with a cow. You start with dogs, you end with dogs. You start with cats, you end with cats. You start with pigs, you end with pigs. And as Darwin found out, who was a tremendously well-respected pigeon breeder, you start with pigeons, you know what you end up with? Pigeons. That's all. And Darwin knew that. Mutations don't account for evolution. There was a conference up in Chicago in 1981 to look at this idea of whether or not mutations could cause evolution, and they said, no, they can't. All the stuff that's being taught on evolution is false. I hate to say it, the evidence just isn't there. When I was in school, we were taught that natural selection, and this is what Darwin based his whole theory on, natural selection. He stole the concept from Sir Edward Blyth, a Christian creationist, who said natural selection would fit perfectly with God's idea that after a flood, you'd have two of every kind of creature coming out. God, if he was a good engineer, would build enough variability into those creatures to where when they bred, they would produce a whole variety within that kind. So that when two rabbits would come off the ark, you would get from those two rabbits, brown rabbits, white rabbits, gray rabbits, pink rabbits, yellow rabbits, you get all different colors of rabbits. And they would migrate into different areas. And when white and brown rabbits would migrate to Alaska, you would have the white rabbit against the snow, the brown rabbit against the snow. Which rabbit would get eaten? Brown rabbit, right? Because the white rabbit would be disguised. White and brown rabbits migrate to South Louisiana. You got white rabbits in the swamp. You got brown rabbits in the swamp. Which one gets eaten? Both. Cajuns eat everything. So they constantly disappear. But what happens is you get creatures with a wide variety, and nature selects. Gee, that's simple. And that's exactly what God would do. If God was a good engineer so that he could get as many creatures on that ark using just as few creatures as he had to get the maximum variety when they got off the ark, he would do it just like that. And you know what? That's exactly what natural selection tells us when we go out in the field and observe. Listen to this from Argos and Stan for you. It does not square with observation. Ruthless struggle between species can be induced artificially in the laboratory, but it is difficult to point out clear examples of mutual harm between mutual species undisturbed by man. You don't see natural selection like Darwin describes it, tooth and nail, struggle for survival, this guy stealing meat out the other one's mouth. That does not occur. Not in nature. That occurs in big cities. The other problem with natural selection cannot create anything. This guy wants to select a new haircut. He doesn't have any hair to select. You can't select what's not there. And the problem with natural selection is that it's got to get new information to make new critters. Remember we said? You can't get what you ain't got. Natural selection does not provide a means for evolution. It provides a means for restricting evolution. And now even the evolutionists are starting to publish that. Can we disprove evolution? Gee, Richard Dawkins says so. He hates us. He hates creation scientists. But he made this statement. He said, if a single well-verified mammal skull were to turn up in 500 million-year-old rocks, our whole modern theory of evolution would be utterly destroyed. What he's saying is if you can find an out-of-place fossil, then it would destroy the whole theory of evolution. Stephen M. Stanley, very well-respected paleontologist, said, there is an infinite variety of ways in which since 1859 the general concepts of evolution might have been demolished. The unequivocal discovery of a fossil population of horses in Precambrian rocks would disprove evolution. More generally, any topsy-turvy sequence of fossils would force us to rethink our theory, yet not a single one has come to light. As Darwin recognized, a single geographic inconsistency would have nearly the same power of destruction. Is there a single area where you have out-of-place fossils? For instance, dinosaurs which became extinct 70 million years ago, if they were found buried together with humans that only showed up on the scene, according to the evolutionists, a few thousand years ago, if you found those two buried together, according to these guys, that's a formal disproof of evolution. Dr. Eugenie Scott said the same thing in her debate in New Orleans with Dr. Dwayne Gish. Let me show you the formal disproof. Thanks to the Paloxy River in the 1970s, they found dinosaur footprints buried next to human footprints. Same layer of rock. The only problem is that towards the middle of the 80s, these human footprints began to take on the appearance of dinosaur footprints. And for a while, we pulled all the data off the thing and we said, well, gee, sure they did look like human footprints. I wonder what's going on. And so finally, in the late 80s, Carl Ball and Don Patton persisted in the research, and what they found, and I'm showing you a contour diagram of that footprint, is that a human being, see the toes, stepped inside the footprint of a dinosaur. And he did it before the limestone that dinosaur stepped in became hard, which would take about 2 hours. Probably a human tracking a dinosaur. Man and dinosaurs live together. Shows it right here. dinosaur footprint. Can you see the toes? See the mud pushed up from the human footprint in there? 14 left-right footprints in sequence. Now, the evolutionists used to say that they were caused. Well, they originally only found 8 footprints, and they led back to a solid wall of mud. And what we creationists did is took a bulldozer and dug up that wall of mud and found 6 more footprints. They weren't caused. They also took the best human footprint, and they cut through the toes, the ball of the foot, and the heel to see if there were pressure lines. If they were caused, you wouldn't have pressure lines. If a 150-pound man stepped in soft limestone, you'd have pressure lines in the heel, ball of the foot, and toes, and guess what they found in each place? Pressure lines. I didn't say that's a formal disproof of evolution. The evolutionists did. The evidence is there. That's why people like Louis Baron, considered one of France's greatest scientists, said, evolution is a fairy tale for grown-ups. This theory has helped nothing in the progress of science. It is useless. And I would agree. The evidence that the evolutionist is constantly throwing out at us just doesn't hold water, but we also need to have some positive evidence. That's why a lot of people say, well, is creation a matter of faith? No. From our standpoint, it's a matter of history, because we have an eyewitness. And they always ask that question, what type of evidence would indicate creation? And whenever they ask that question, I always ask this question. Yo, this is a question. I'm going to do that tonight. I'm going to go over 10 questions that you should always ask folks. This is one of the questions I always ask. What evidence are you prepared to accept? Because if they say none, it's almost like when Jesus said, don't cast your pearls before swine. I think you need to answer them, but you need to recognize how open-minded they're going to be. And they'll believe impossible things before you do it. The whole issue with evidence for creation is, can you recognize design? Because design comes from a designer. And I'll end with this. When you look at Mount Rushmore, two theories about Mount Rushmore that are prevalent today. Either wind and water erosion over millions of years caused the faces of presidents on the side of the mountain, or you had intelligent men come and sculpt them. What do you think? When you look at human DNA, enough evidence to fill 2,000 volumes of books, 500 pages each with the smallest readable print, what do you think? What's the most logical answer? In science, we call it Occam's razor. We say, take the most logical explanation, the simplest explanation, and apply it. And that's what we should do. What about hard physical evidence, Mike? Sure. Bob Gentry's little polonium halos. Those halos are the result. He takes rocks way, way down in the bottom of the earth. For all you technical folks, he calls them Precambrian granite, basement layer rocks. He slices the crystals real, real thin, and he looks in the microscope. And other scientists have done this, and they find these halos. And I wish I had a color picture because they're beautiful. And from the number of rings and the size of the rings, you can tell what element formed them. And those are polonium halos. Now, polonium halos are interesting because he finds a lot of polonium-218 halos by themselves. The problem is that it only takes 3 minutes for polonium. That's the half-life on polonium. Within 7 to 10 half-lives, all the polonium disappears. What's the problem? The evolutionist tells us that for several million years, the Earth was liquid. You can't form polonium halos in a liquid medium. Like putting a firecracker in your aquarium and exploding it. Does it leave ripples? Not after a few minutes. But if you exploded that firecracker in a bowl of Jell-O, you could come back tomorrow, slice through that Jell-O, and you'd see, just like you see here in the Jell-O, rings from where that firecracker exploded. Maybe not in Jell-O. What about putty? You'd see rings. Well, we see polonium halos in these rocks that supposedly took millions of years to form, but within 30 minutes there would have been no polonium left. How is that possible? It's not. Has anyone challenged Gentry? Never successfully. And I got a letter from a nuclear physicist several weeks ago, about 2 months ago. He called Gentry and he said, and I wrote him back and asked him, how does he explain Gentry? And he said, well, I explain it the way everybody else does. We don't know yet, but we'll figure it out. And I asked him, why didn't he just take the most logical explanation that those basement layers of rock were formed instantaneously with polonium already inside, just like God said. Just like God said. There's a lot of evidence out there, huh? So much so that I got all of these transparencies that I didn't get to on the flood. Come back tonight and we'll go through those real, real quickly. If you have any questions, please write them down. We'll clean up the gap theory tonight. But let me just encourage you this. I know you can't get all this information today, but I'm going to encourage you to do just what Paul did to Timothy. Study to show yourself approved. there's a lot of information out there. Hosea 4:6, my people perish for lack of knowledge, not lack of good church music, not lack of good desserts, because y'all got good desserts out here. But that information is out there. Take a little time to study it. Become familiar with it. But don't be afraid. When those folks ask you a question, when they challenge you, there's answers out there. If you don't know them and if you can't find them, he's got my home number. Please call me. I'll help you, or I'll put you in touch with the folks that can. But God is true in everything he says. Everything he says. And as Romans 1:20 says, the evidence is so overwhelming that if they don't see it, they're without excuse. My duty is to show it to them.
Just to worry about tomorrow, I guess we're supposed to have a dramatic weather change. But everything is on, the golf tournament tomorrow, and then in the evening, Mackin Park. We are in a shelter house. There are only three or four. Which one is it? Do you remember, Jay? Shelter house number one. So we can handle a little rain and what have you. That shouldn't be a problem. Picnic tomorrow night, 6 o'clock. Pack up, bring your food, and we'll meet you at Mackin Park.